What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar.
Oh my God, you have no compassion.
Actually, I'm just bored because I know everything you're going to do before you do it.
Sure you do.
Oh, you don't believe me?
No, I don't.
I'm going to write down the next thing you're going to say to me.
I'm not going to play
your little games, Nadine.
Mother-daughter Kira Sedgwick and Haley Steinfeld in a scene from the new teen comedy The Edge of 17. Sorry if that triggered any post-Thanksgiving PTSD for some listeners.
You know, I hate to admit it, but I identify more with the mom than the teen daughter in that scene.
I'm right there with you. The Edge of 17 got strong reviews when it opened wide a couple weeks back, but it's getting overlooked at the box office. Our own recommendation, plus guest Mariah Gates from TCM and the Female Filmmaker Friday podcast, Say That Three Times Fast, joins us for the top five teenage girl movies directed by women.
That and more.
Sometimes, Josh, I know what you're going to say before you say it, too.
Ahead on Film Spotting.
Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
It's our first time back in the studio since our Chicago Podcast Festival live show back on November 18th. Our thanks again to everyone who came out to Shuba's for that and to those of you who caught up with it by podcast or on the radio last week, and all of you who have shared your thoughts on our top five movies that console and restore hope, positive or otherwise.
It was kind of nice getting to spend a night out and record a show at the same time, knocking both of those. We should do that more often.
I agree. Maybe we should. How was your Thanksgiving? Josh, I did have 19 people at my house, 11 kids, 8 adults. But one of those...
So the kids did outnumber the adults. That is
totally
always a dangerous situation.
But one of the kids was new baby Stella. My sister Megan just had her third child. So it was awesome having a 5-day-old baby, basically a week-old baby at the house there for Thanksgiving. We survived it. It was fun.
So that's a week-old baby ranging up to 14? Was that the top end?
Yeah, I think the oldest was my son Holden at 14.
Was my guess. Mine was probably much more peaceful. As I mentioned, wasn't at our house this year. I had said I'd probably do some dishes to help out. I didn't even end up doing that.
No?
So
I did a little dishes.
I was really lazy.
Well, we're going to get to some Thanksgiving movie talk a little bit later in the show. We have a poll question about Moana, and we have both seen that and may share a couple thoughts. And we may also talk a little bit of Allied, the new Robert Zemeckis film, which you saw much to my surprise.
Much to your shock.
Yeah, genuinely shocked, only because, and I like Zemeckis's films for the most part. I'm still, I guess I would have to say, mixed on Brad Pitt overall as a leading man, despite loving a few of his performances.
Yeah.
Big fan of Marion Cotillard, but something about the subject matter and the time of year just had me with no interest at all in this film. And what I mean is, I had to put together, and I wonder if you do the same, a list of my priorities, the movies I hope to fit in before we have to
absolutely
do our top 10 films of the year. We have to do our voting in various ballots, including the Chicago Film Critics Association. And I have two categories, the ones I definitely need to see, and then that second tier. And if you number them, I had Allied as my 31st priority.
I don't know if Allied is on my list of things that I need to see before making my top 10 list. Zemeckis films have been on top 10 lists before, but it was very high up on my list of movies to see with Debbie the night before Thanksgiving when we didn't have to prepare for dinner the next day.
Right.
So things kind of, the equation got mixed up a little bit there, but I am glad I saw it.
Yeah, you liked it.
We'll maybe get into it a little bit more.
Share a couple thoughts.
Okay. I don't think it would sway you further to the pro side on Brad Pitt, but I am curious to know and to hear from others whether they think his dimness in this film, and that's not necessarily star wattage, but the character he plays, is on purpose, because that character is supposed to be a little bit behind the Marion Cotillard character. There's always a question throughout the film, who can you trust between them? These World War II era spies who end up together, but you don't quite know where they stand. As a throwback, and I'm a huge fan of Zemeckis' Hitchcock spin, What Lies Beneath, I think it works pretty well, not as well as that one does. So I enjoyed it on that level. I enjoyed the costumes immensely. Zemeckis gets a little carried away with the green screen. That detracts from some of that period sensibility. So, yeah, I wouldn't say you need to rush out and see this before the end of the year, but I enjoyed it.
Not going to make your top 10.
No.
But glad you saw it.
Yes.
I'm very glad I caught up with Arrival over the Thanksgiving holiday, just before Thanksgiving. And I'm just going to go on the record right now and say that despite being generally pretty favorable on it, you and Michael Phillips were both completely wrong in your review and not favorable enough. Now, I haven't actually listened to the review, but I still wanted to get that on the record.
Thanks for giving us a shot.
Exactly. I think maybe we will talk a little bit of Arrival for our podcast listeners if they actually stay tuned to the end credits. Maybe a little bit of spoiler talk on that film.
Well, if you had listened to the review, I expressed a desire to perhaps get into spoiler talk with you at some point if you had seen it. But now seeing how dismissive you've been, I don't know if I want to do that.
I love that you think I might be any kind of authority on this, as if I wasn't confused as all get out as
well.
You
got to explain the whole thing to me.
Okay, well, I think I may be able to.
What I've learned is if you didn't get it within the first 3 minutes, you're an idiot. So
is that the threshold there?
It's kind of what people like to pretend.
Okay, well then, I may be in a little bit of trouble, but I am a big fan of the film, and I definitely highly recommend Arrival if you haven't seen it already. And along with those films, there were other big Thanksgiving releases like the much-anticipated Manchester by the Sea from Kenneth Lonergan. That finally made it to Chicago this past weekend, and we had originally planned to review it this week, and I have seen it already. I did find time after everybody went to bed before Thanksgiving. I sat down and took in that film, and we do expect to talk about it at some point here in detail on the show. But as an alternative to that, this week, we'd been considering the well-reviewed teen comedy, The Edge of 17, and then I saw some tweets from Mariah E. Gates. They read, "The Edge of 17 is underperforming at the box office. If you are upset about the lack of women hired to direct by studios and don't go see this movie, you are part of the problem and you need to think about that. You can't just complain about a thing and not actually try to help fix the thing. This is the last wide-release film directed by a woman in theaters this calendar year. Go put your money where your mouth is." So we're all about trying to actually help fix the thing that we too sometimes complain about, and that was enough to convince us to go see 17. Later in the show, we'll talk to Mariah Gates about that very effective tweet storm and much more, including her top five teenage girl movies directed by women.
But first, Adam and I did our part when it came to The Edge of 17. No press screening for us. We ponied up some cash at the actual box office. Spoiler, it was money well spent.
There are two types of people in the world. The people who naturally excel at life.
Golden boy.
What's up?
And the people who hope all those people die in a big explosion. Look at that stupid shirt my brother's wearing. When I was 13, it was clear which side of the equation I was on.
Are you even up there?
But that's what best friends are for. Nick is like right there.
God, Juby made him so hot.
And I had Krista.
Krista!
Oh my God! My brother? Seriously?
I can't help how I feel.
You turn into a completely different person.
Why don't you try being positive?
Mom, I'm gonna write down the next thing you're gonna say.
I'm not playing your little games, Nadine.
Congratulations.
You have all the answers, don't you?
No, which is why I wish I had a mother who would notice.
When I was young. We mentioned Mariah Gates, who we're gonna hear from in a little bit, and in her YouTube review of The Edge of 17, she noted that she felt it was a very honest look at the angst of being a teenage girl. "I have been there. I have been that alone. I have broken up with a friend like that," Mariah said. One thing neither of us will be able to say about Kelly Freeman Craig's directing debut from her own screenplay is that The Edge of 17 is a very honest look at the angst of being a teenage girl, despite the fact that you're currently raising one with another following close behind, and I've got one of my own just on the edge of 13. But not even the world's most helicopter parent could get inside the mind of their high school-age daughter as deeply as Freeman Craig and her star Hailee Steinfeld do here, mainly because Steinfeld's Nadine insists on voicing every thought on her mind, no matter how hurtful it might be. At one point late in the film, Nadine's mom, played by Kira Sedgwick, offers this nugget of wisdom: "Everyone else in the world is as miserable and empty as I am. They're just better at hiding it." Nadine isn't just really bad at hiding it, she actually seems intent on spreading her misery to as many people as possible. Whether it's her high-maintenance mom, droll, mostly disinterested teacher, played by Woody Harrelson, her all-too-perfect jock brother Darian, or her best friend Krista, who has the audacity to start dating her all-too-perfect jock brother. So Josh, If your masculinity perhaps prevents you from understanding the precise angst of a modern teenage girl, what still felt honest to you about the age of 17? Or were Nadine's struggles only familiar to you because of all the other teen comedies that have come before it?
Oh, no. This is nothing like, even though the story maybe hits some familiar beats as it goes further along, this is really nothing in terms of nuance and feeling and emotion like the majority of teen movies. And, you know, I am sure there are particulars that I am missing just because of my gender. But honestly, this whole thing rang so true, not so much from what I'm experiencing now as a father, but from having had female friends in high school, having married one, and just knowing and remembering, and movies that capture it so well bring these things back in a flood, what that was like, whether you're a guy or a girl, this idea of trying to find out who you are, which identity to put at the forefront, which one to lead with, and which one is the one that feels true and also puts you in right relationship with the people that matter, your family and your friends, or in this case, a teacher that you respect. Those are all things everyone can relate to. Those are the things that this movie nails so well. And those are the things that Steinfeld absolutely captures in what we could call a star-making performance if she had not already broken out to a degree in 2010's True Grit from the Coen brothers. Now there, I think this is still something of a breakout, because what she managed to do there was juggle that dialogue they gave her and do it with precision.
Yeah, a more mannered performance.
It was more mannered. It was more of not a caricature, but there was a lot of comedy going on there. Here, this is a person. You know, and the contemporary setting helps too in getting us to identify with her. But this is a person you can imagine being out at the high school you might drive by every day. And what I think Steinfeld captures so well is this idea of a teenager trying on so many masks every day and trying to, again, figure out what that identity is going to be. And Steinfeld doesn't just show us scenes where Nadine is pretending and then later show us quieter scenes where we see the real Nadine. She does it all at once in the same scene. And what we understand is her sneer and her smile, they're both her, right? It's not that the sneer is a mask. It is a front she's putting on to some degree, but it's also who she really is. She has that sarcastic
streak. I think she's an open book mostly,
And she's partly wearing her, I mean, yeah, you're right. The way she says and blurts out what's on her mind, she is an open book, but also in the way she dresses, the sort of anti-fashion wardrobe she has, the vulgarity, the sexual vulgarity of her language is very much a front. I mean, that's something that is frankness that's serving as a guise, if that makes sense. That's being an open book in one way, only to protect yourself from a roiling insecurity that's still underneath. And the fact that Steinfeld can show us all of that in one scene marks her as, we already, you know, knew she was a talent to be aware of, and I know she's done other things since, but really as someone you want to catch everything she does from now on.
She was pretty fantastic in a little gem called Pitch Perfect 2, Josh, I'll remind you. She has...
Still need to catch up with that one.
Yeah, add it to your list here at the end of the year, even though it's from last year. I think it'll be worth your time. She's very good in that film. She's even better here. And of course, the whole film is built around her. She's fantastic. And I think we can talk about her a little bit more as we get through the review. But as you talk about the movie getting right, the idea of identity and trying to figure out who you are, what I think about is the stakes of it. And Sam's great line that he had back when we reviewed the movie Brick, a film that very much this bizarre neo-noir from Rian Johnson that took place nevertheless in a high school. Sam talked about that film getting right that everything in high school feels like it's life and death. And certainly it feels that way to Hailee Steinfeld's Nadine here. I feel really guilty. You were dead on in saying that this movie has its own path, that Kelly Freeman Craig carves her own path despite maybe some familiar scenes or tropes we've seen in other teen comedies and other teen girl coming-of-age movies. I'm with you. And because of that, I feel really bad about basing the substance of a review of a movie on how it compares to other similar movies. But the fact is, I have to come up with something else to say, Josh, beyond just that this is really funny and really smart and really honest with really great performances. Within the first 30 seconds of the movie, it's Nadine in crisis. She comes in to school and she sits down in front of her teacher played by, as we said, Woody Harrelson. And she starts rattling on about this horrible situation she's gotten herself into right away. I mean, 30 seconds, I'm thinking about Juno, and I'm thinking about Easy A.
Yeah, right.
And those are both movies I really like. So it isn't in its differences, and I think The Edge of 17 is a very different film from those two films. It's not better because it's different, but it is really good that it's different. I appreciate different things about it than I did about those two films. And for me, anyway, the point of comparison is useful because the characters in those two films, and what I'm basing it on mainly in that first 30 seconds, is her look, as you said, reminds me a little bit of Ellen Page being somewhat out of style from the rest of everyone else in the school. And then Easy A, the way she sits down and talks to that teacher, the way I seem to recall Olive in that film talking to, I think, Thomas Hayden Church's character. They have an odd relationship, I guess you'd say, for a student and a teacher. But the difference between Nadine here and those characters is they're the outcasts we as audience members latch onto and favor over all the other dimwits
right.
who make up the rest of the movie, all these really normal, boring people, because they're so much more enlightened and wittier and they're more thoughtful and they use their words to really separate themselves from everyone else. Nadine here is genuinely really difficult and destructive. And I love that about her. And her verbal acuity is actually, I think, her downfall. She talks so much that she never lets anyone else get a word in. She actually never really considers anybody else's point of view but her own. She's that solipsistic. And if she was just that solipsistic and obnoxious on top of it, she wouldn't be interesting at all. There wouldn't be any pathos to it, certainly. But I think that Steinfeld is just so good as an actress that she infuses it with so much vulnerability that you do tap into that and you are rooting for her to an extent, but also you recognize in her that she is a different type of character than someone like Juno, who comes from a pretty good home with parents who are pretty understanding and are there by her side through this whole difficult process. And we see Nadine here, she comes from a place where her father has died. Difficult relationship with her brother, difficult relationship with her mother, definitely doesn't fit in at school. And there's a real self-hatred to her that I do think is relatable, regardless of how much of a first world problem person she may come across as. I mean, the fact is, at the end of the day, she is Hailee Steinfeld. So it's not like she's the ugliest duckling in the school. But I still think that despite there being some people in the world who might look at her or others like her and say, you're being ridiculous, you have no reason to be as self-loathing as you are, that doesn't change the fact that they genuinely feel that self-loathing. And we have no doubts about how she feels about herself and how that manifests itself because of the great writing and the directing and the performance.
Yeah, absolutely. It goes back to Sam's idea about everything being life or death. I mean, that's something I realized early on as a parent, is when this little scribbled, I don't even know what it is, that my toddler is handing me that means nothing to me, to them, in those 3 minutes, that's their life masterpiece, right? And so it's that switch of perspective of what does this mean in this growing person's mind at this moment. That's where the movie puts us.
Is it too late for me to learn this perspective?
You can find those scribbles somewhere. Take them out now and say, I've been holding this forever, because it means so much. But that's what this movie does. It shows you what's going inside in her head and makes you feel how important it is. And the bravery of the performance is that she is so unlikable. You're absolutely right. Harrelson's a more likable person.
Yeah.
Her brother, played by
Blake Jenner.
Blake Jenner from
Everybody Wants Him.
Yep, he's very good here. I mean, yeah, he's a little bit of a goody two shoes and a mama's boy, but he has a great moment where he explains why he's like that.
Yeah.
And it also comes from,
it's part of his character for us to take him for granted, just like everyone else
exactly.
in the film does.
And, you know, that my sister said something along the lines, she saw it too. And we were talking about this character and how unlikable she might be. And, you know, she said, well, look at what she's dealing with. Mm-hmm. You know, look at what her home life is like. And I think the other thing to remember that the movie knows as well, and this is what her teacher I think knows and why he's the smartest guy, is that this is a person in development. And that's what is very difficult sometimes to remember about teenagers, is when they present themselves as finished products, you want to take them as finished products, right? But they're not. They're not at all. And Nadine very much presents herself as a finished product. She knows how the world works. That's what she's showing you in her dress and, again, her language. But when she's alone, she has no idea how the world works. She's still trying to figure that out. And so the movie really allows us to see her as that person in formation stuff.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. One of the things I can relate to all too sadly is the way she really does only define herself in relation to other people. She doesn't really have a sense of herself except as she sees herself as being deficient to others or extraordinary, but even that we can't completely buy because there's one point where she goes on this whole lament about how she's really an old soul and yeah. she's into this and she's into that and none of these other idiots at school are into those things. And I'm watching it thinking, none of that actually rings true with her character. No. There's nothing we have seen so far that really suggests she's into any of those things, but she believes it. And if this was Easy A or Juno, again, films I really love, if it was those films and those performances, those characters, there'd be a little bit of a wink to the character spouting those cliches. She knows that she's railing against the world. But in this moment, this character, Nadine, and Steinfeld, because of her performance, there's no winking at all. She really believes she's that extraordinary slash completely insufficient person. So that's another thing that comes through in that performance. I just think that she, as an actress, Steinfeld, is she's kind of a freak. I don't want to hyperbolize, but then you can't really say that and follow it up with what I'm about to say. But she does strike me as so preternaturally talented that the only person I can really think to compare her to is like a Meryl Streep. Someone who can't articulate for you what it is she's doing on the screen, but just can do it. Yeah. I think that's Steinfeld.
I think if you look at Jennifer Lawrence in Winter's Bone, in particular, yeah. you see that sort of ability very
early. She just
early
disappears
on.
Into these characters.
Yeah.
Steinfeld
yeah.
does.
She does. Now, we've talked about Kelly Freeman Craig as director. This is her screenplay, too. And as a directorial debut, I think it's smart in that she doesn't stray too far from Steinfeld's face.
No.
With that much going on, you want to stay pretty close. But there are also nice moments where she'll isolate Nadine in the scene completely by herself, whether it's in the hallway at school, or we mentioned it's not really a spoiler because it's telegraphed and happens fairly early on that her dad dies. And there is mm-hmm. a scene of her in the hospital room with her mother and brother and just the staging there so that those two are together embracing on one side of the bed and she's alone on the other side watching them. Very much sets up the family dynamic that's going to come into play through the rest of the story. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, Freeman Craig makes some interesting choices with the camera and the character placement and that sort of thing that does add to what's going on
here. I'm with you completely. I don't think it's overly fussy, nor should it be. I think that she does seem to have a gift for knowing where to place the camera and working with her editor, knowing where to cut and where the beats are. I definitely felt that watching this film without there being too many shots that seem to call attention to themselves at all. I also appreciated, as I mentioned, that first 30 seconds where we see her running into school. The car pulls up. We see her get out. One thing I noticed right away, in contrast to some of these other teen movies I've mentioned, is that it's really pretty drab. It doesn't look like Easy A. It doesn't have the kind of quirky style that you get with Juno. It feels like Oregon, which is where this movie is set. Mm-hmm. It looks a little gray. It isn't a film that is trying to mine the environment for humor or to garner any style points. It really does seem in keeping with the overall mood and tone of the entire film, which is quite funny at times, without a doubt. But as we've said, it's also really grounded in pathos.
So there are cartoon high schools at the movies and there are real high schools
that's
at the movies, right? And both can work. I mean, Clueless, for example, you mm-hmm. would say is a cartoon high school. This is a real one. And I yep. think that's exactly the way you want to go with this story.
Yeah, very, very well said. I do want to give a little extra praise here. I don't know that we've done enough for Woody Harrelson as the teacher.
So
now,
good.
I love Woody Harrelson. I mean, he can do almost no wrong for me, and he's going to make any movie better. But what did occur to me that makes the performance so good is the way it's in stark contrast to Steinfeld's performance and the tempo
yes.
of that character, where she's always talking. She's always letting her feelings be known, again, much to the dismay of people who are trying to engage in a conversation with her, and they tend to get frustrated, and then that just amps up the intensity of the scene. He's the one character that just sits there and listens. And then he takes so much time getting
respond.
To his point and responding at all that it diffuses her in a way. So they play off each other so well, I think, because he clearly made a decision to not try to match at all the intensity of that character.
Look, I don't want to take up a ton of your time, but I'm going to kill myself. I just thought that someone should know. I don't really know how this works. I'm probably going to jump off an overpass in front of a semi. So, or a U-Haul, maybe just on a bus. I'm not going to be a dick and make people watch, but it has to be big. It's got to be so big that it just, done, kills me, lights out. Because if it just maims me, and I'm like, well then, how's that good for anyone? Then I got to find a nurse to smother me. How am I going to get across smothering if I'm... We don't need to get caught up in the minutia. I just thought that an adult, so you should know.
Wow, this is a lot to take in, Nadine. I wish I knew what to say. Well, I was actually just drafting my own suicide note just now.
Yeah, and I'm so glad the movie opens with him too, because he does become our eyes. He's the most patient with her. He's the one we start to see her through. And he also gets his response to her threat in that opening scene, gets a huge laugh. So that opens up
some
breathing space, and also shows he can speak her language of sarcasm, right? So you see why they're connected.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. I did see one critic, I don't remember who it was, but they noted all of the familiar tropes. They were praising the movie, but think about how many teen movies you've seen where there's a scene on a Ferris wheel and a scene in a swimming pool and all the scenes in cars and all the stuff that is absolutely true. But there are so many nice little twists that Freeman Craig gives us here. Some of these reveals that I don't want to spoil, but we mentioned the brother and we have a sense of sort of taking him for granted as a very bland, dull character. We have a bit of a surprise there. We look at the teacher, played by Woody Harrelson, the same way, of course, through her eyes, through Nadine's eyes. We have a little bit of a surprise with him. And even, we haven't mentioned, her love interest, who becomes one of her love interests in the film, Irwin, he has an entirely separate life that she doesn't perceive. And of course, then we don't perceive either. So all of these perceptions that she has and that we then as an audience have are ultimately subverted in some way. And I think if you were going to try to put a tag on what growing up means, if you want to talk about what maturity means, it's casting aside, being able to cast aside those illusions you have of the world and actually recognizing what's going on around you and who the people are around you.
Hayden Zetso plays the boyfriend material that she can't quite recognize. He is quite good. And there is a touch in one of those scenes that I think you're referencing. Let's just say she's on a date in a car and she makes a comment about, oh, what a nice view. And the guy she's with pulls into a spot that's right facing, what is it, a trash compactor? Yeah. I mean, those are the little twists I think you're talking about that this movie has.
For sure. And I do think you talked about sex a little bit earlier. As female teen comedies go, you don't see as many that are this frank. Maybe films like Fast Times at Ridgemont High, but some of those others I've mentioned, Say Anything, sex happens in these films or it's talked about, but I don't think as bluntly as it is here. And I thought that was a standout element of the movie. But I did want to ask you one thing, see if you had any similar feelings. We're talking about her kind of self-loathing and this real deep-rooted insecurity that drives the whole story without question. There are a couple of points where in the way she describes what she's going through, it sounds very much, and I'm far from an expert on this, but it sounds very much like someone who you could say is very clearly suffering from depression. And she could fit that bill, of course, because she is grieving, even though her father's death, I think, was 3 or 4 years ago. And there's a great bit with Woody Harrelson about that, where she tries to get out of an assignment
so good.
Because of her father's death. I mean, it's just perfect in the movie. The movie doesn't really go there. And I don't know if it's to its credit or to its discredit that it doesn't want to seem to actually paint her as a character who may be suffering from real depression as opposed to just teen girl angst.
Yeah, well,
whatever that is.
Right. Where do you draw that line is one thing, but also, you know, obviously professionals do is what I mean. But also there is the scene where Irwin calls her and she's just taken a pill.
Yeah.
And she does say, I'm going to call you back. I just took a pill. And
that's the closest it might be to admitting to that.
Right. Like she had something after her father's death immediately she was taking and had held on to it is how I think I recall it. So
yeah,
there's definitely
a
reference to it's been somewhat in her past. It is not directly addressed as something she's dealing with immediately in the framework of this story.
Mm-hmm. It's a fantastic film and we are really glad we saw it. We hope it is not too late for many of you to catch up with it as well. The Edge of 17 is out now in wide release, though it is not playing on as many screens as it was when it opened, so don't wait. If you see it and agree or disagree with our takes, you can email us feedback@filmspotting.net. Couple quick plugs for the Film Spotting family of podcasts. we were not alone on the stage at Shuba's as part of the Chicago Podcast Festival. Our friends from Film Spotting SVU, Matt and Allison, also taped their show there. And if you weren't in attendance, you can hear that show now. They had a little bit of a similar topic to us, but of course, their own spin on it.
Well, they talked about cinematic comfort food and also debuted the Sfuvatron 5000. Is that what it was?
Complete with special effects.
It was very effective.
It was.
You can find that at filmspottingsvu.com to listen to that show. Of course, you can find it wherever you listen to your podcast. Film Spotting SVU is presented by Movies on Demand on cable, the Art House in your house. Learn more at rentmoviesondemand.com.
And our friends at the Next Picture Show performed at the Steppenwolf Theater here, and they were inspired by one of the year's biggest indie sensations, Barry Jenkins' Moonlight, to look at another highly romanticized tale of unrequited love, Wong Kar-wai's 2000 film, In the Mood for Love. So their two shows this past week here focus on Moonlight and In the Mood for Love. Talk about a sumptuous double feature there. We encourage you to check out the Next Picture Show as well, wherever you find podcasts, or go to nextpictureshow.net.
I'm right in between those two installments now. I can't wait to get to Moonlight. All right, Adam, brace yourself. The results of the Film Spotting poll up next may just mean a moratorium on any more Hamilton talk.
Okay.
We'll also share some brief Moana thoughts and weigh in on a few last-minute candidates for this year's Golden Brick Award. Stay with us.
Heard you play, and I wanted. It's pretty strange that we keep running into each other.
Maybe it means something.
I doubt it.
Yeah, I don't think so. You could just write your own roles, you know, write something that's as interesting as you are.
What are you gonna do?
I have my own club.
Beautiful People, Ryan Gosling and Emma Stone in the trailer for Damien Chazelle's La La Land, which will be rolling out to theaters this month. Certainly one of our most anticipated movies of this holiday season.
I think it's at the top of my list. Well, maybe Scorsese Silence. I don't know. Mm. It's tough, but La La Land, it's right up there.
Yeah, it's right up there for me with Manchester by the Sea, which now that I've finally seen that, La La Land is next in line, and it's next in line for us right now as we're going to review it. That is the plan, to review it on next week's episode with Michael Phillips. We'll share a few more details about that planned episode later in this episode. We did want to mention, again, that we have many free passes to give away to our Chicago area listeners, some advanced screening passes so you can see it before it hits theaters, or some passes that are available for its run of engagement here in Chicago. Among those movies, Miss Sloan starring Jessica Chastain, Lion starring Dev Patel, Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk, still some passes for that to give away, the new Ang Lee film. You can enter to win passes to those films at filmspotting.net right there in the top stories.
So not free, but I think we can say worth your money.
We hope.
Our upcoming live show, that's going to be January 13. It's our 2016 wrap party. We do this every year, celebrating the best of the year with idiosyncratic picks, whether it's most moving moment, things like that. We'll have video clips, live music. It's always a lot of fun. So yeah, that is going to be on January 13. It's part of a set of shows, actually, through WBEZ. The topic is cinema, so we're a perfect fit for that. Nerdette is also going to be a part of it. Their live show is December 21 at Victory Gardens. We're going to be in Hyde Park this year. We're heading over to the University of Chicago and make a bit of a mess of their brand new Logan Center for the Arts.
It's immaculate, and it's a big space. So please do bring all your film spotting friends, or all your friends who are tired of you talking about film spotting. We're going to need some help padding the crowd, I think, a little bit with this live show, but we can't wait. And Josh, you mentioned the categories, because we were just discussing this a little bit behind the scenes. Do we go with the same format as last year, which was a new format, and we thought it worked very well. We picked six categories, kind of our awards, looking at, I think we had best opening scene in there.
We
had best action scene. We had best kind of tear-jerking scene, funniest scene. We could go with those again, all six of them, or four of them, or five, or three of them, or whatever, or mix it up a little bit and think about some categories, kind of like we do with our marathons when we do our awards, that really do apply to this year, if that even makes sense. So, well, I'm just throwing it out there to listeners if they've got a creative category.
Yeah. I think that's a good thing to do, because really we put in best action scene so we could just talk about Mad Max
Fury Road.
So
100%.
So there might be a similar situation this year where a movie of a different genre needs to be celebrated.
All right. Film spotting poll question time. Last time we talked polls, Josh, it was pre-Thanksgiving, pre-live show, pre-election.
Another era.
We were so innocent then. At the time, we were looking ahead to Thanksgiving week releases, specifically to the release of Disney's Moana. We asked you simply, Moana is, and here were your choices, the movie I look forward to bringing my kids to Thanksgiving weekend, the movie I will reluctantly bring my kids to Thanksgiving weekend, the only Hamilton ticket I can afford, enough of the damn Hamilton talk, this is a movie podcast, or other. Write in your own sarcastic, cynical response. Josh, how did the results come out?
All right. I don't know if you're ready for this.
I'm not.
But in last place with 3% was the movie I look forward to bringing my kids to Thanksgiving weekend. Other then came in with 12%. Close to that was the movie I will reluctantly bring my kids to Thanksgiving weekend. That received 13% of the vote. In second place, the only Hamilton ticket I can afford, 28% of the vote, resoundingly winning this poll. Enough of the damn Hamilton talk. This is a movie podcast, 43% of the vote. Adam, I don't think I've ever seen Film Spotting Nation turn on you in this
way. I know. I usually come out ahead in these polls.
I didn't think it could happen.
Hashtag Team Adam is not in place here.
No.
No, and I'm a little bit disillusioned, too, by the fact that the movie I look forward to bringing my kids to Thanksgiving weekend, 3%. Maybe we just have a lot of listeners out there who don't have kids, or they have no hearts. I don't know which is the case.
Or they were taking their kids to Allied.
Yeah, I'm sure that was it. Well, I felt a little better after I read some of the comments, including this one from Anna H. I voted for Enough of the Damn Hamilton Talk, not necessarily because this is a movie podcast or because I hate Hamilton, but because I live in Montana. The chances of me getting to see Hamilton on stage are about the same as me seeing Wicked or the Book of Mormon or any amazing Broadway play on stage. A slim chance.
Fair point, Anna. Will from LA said, close to choosing Enough of the Damn Hamilton Talk because I love it, haven't seen it, and every little review you guys give, I imagine you two smiling devilishly as you dole out the details of this masterpiece of a show. Adam has seen it twice. Is that where all the film spotting donation money is going? Alas, I will not take the bait to put my miserable Adam / Josh jealousy on Moana, which, by the way, LA gets the world premiere of at AFI Fest, which I will be attending. Take that. So I will settle on it being the only Hamilton ticket I can afford.
All right, Hamilton, three times. I'm going in April.
No, you're not.
I'm going back in April. I got tickets. Ticketmaster.
You're sick.
I got tickets on Ticketmaster. Taking the whole family again.
There are other
again.
Things you no. should start taking in and spending your money on at this point.
I'm not supposed to be talking about this, so I don't know. I don't know why I keep bringing it up. Steve Kimes, it's sad that Moana is getting caught up in the wake of Hamilton. Disney always puts a lot of effort into their princess movies, and a Disney movie with all their talents present is always something to see. There's a number of reasons to see this film, and the connection to Hamilton is the least of them. My kids are too old to be swept up by Disney's allure, so my wife and I will probably see it on our own.
Good for you, Steve. Michael and El Cerrito said, saw it, and it was flat out terrific. Thought often to myself, Adam is going to dig these songs, and rightfully so. The most well-paced, thoughtful, and altogether lovely non-Pixar film from Disney in a long time. Oh, and my daughter loved it too, I guess. So that's the question for me.
Yeah.
As the Hamilton fanatic, did Lin-Manuel Miranda's contribution to the songs, because I don't think any of them are purely written music and lyrics by him. He has
100%, maybe not.
Yeah. So did that live up to your expectations, the music?
The music did, absolutely. Okay. And I appreciate all of the different collaborators and all the different voices we hear. But that main song that we do hear, and we very clearly hear Lin-Manuel Miranda's voice in How Far I'll Go, I mean, that is the standout song in the entire movie. And it was a song that was in my head for at least 3 days after. And I'll say the big Hamilton fanatic in my family isn't even me. It's my daughter, Sophie. And she really loved the music and really heard a lot of the Hamilton connections there in the melodies. And as I touched on when we were previewing Moana a while back, it's not just the actual sound of the music, but it's the content and the themes in the music as well overlap with some of those themes in Hamilton. So I think the music is a strength of the film. I think the visuals generally are a strength of the film. I really like this film. I don't know that I have much more to say about it, Josh. I went over Thanksgiving, actually the day before, with a bunch of my family. We actually had an entire row at the AMC there. We took up the entire space, and I think it was 3 adults to 7 kids. And I'm just going to say, I'm never quite able in one of those situations to just totally sit back in my chair and relax and take in the movie and be critical about it. Nothing really about Moana surprised me, but nothing disappointed me either. Yeah. The Rock was just as charming and charismatic as I expect him to be. As I said, the songs were great. I thought the storyline generally was solid. So I'm in on Moana.
So I'm going to say my favorite song was You're Welcome, actually. And now that I know this is a safe place for anti-Hamilton thoughts, Lin-Manuel Miranda's singing voice is probably not his strongest attribute, right? So turns out Dwayne Johnson, The Rock, he can sing pretty well. And that fits, as you're saying, his personality, the role that he plays, Maui, this very haughty, hubristic demigod. And so there's a lot of humor that comes from that. I think he pulls off that song really well.
Okay. I see what's happening, yeah. You're face to face with greatness and it's strange. You don't even know how you feel. It's adorable. Well, it's nice to see that humans never change. Open your eyes, let's begin. Yes, it's really me, it's Maui, breathe it in. I know it's a lot, the hair, the bod. When you're staring at a demigod, what can I say except you're welcome? For the tides, the sun, the sky. Hey, it's okay, it's okay, you're welcome. I'm just an ordinary demigod.
I do think that, you know, this is drawn from an amalgamation of Polynesian myths. So although there will be critics of it not capturing a specific culture very well, I think it's interesting and good that we're at least getting an exposure to other stories and can see how they resonate with some of the myths we're already familiar with, or the myths, the princess myths that Disney has told in previous films. And to that extent, I think it is important that Moana, the title character, is voiced by a girl, teen girl of Hawaiian descent, Alui Crivello, and even little details like the fact that they pay attention to the texture of her hair. You know, that this is not silky smooth, usual Disney princess hair, but this is something that has spring to it, that holds the water differently. That's just one element of the exquisite animation here.
Well, that all brings us to our new poll question. It's hard to believe, but our top 10 films of the year roundtable is only 2 weeks away.
Oh, shit.
Giving me much anxiety. We have a lot to fill in before we sit down with Scott Tobias and Michael Phillips for that show. At this point in years past, we've asked you to name your favorite film of 2016, knowing full well that it's not a question you really have much interest in answering until sometime in mid-January or later, when you've had a chance to see some of these late-year releases and take in more movies. We're actually pretty much in the same boat with you. We tweaked it a little bit this time to focus on the movies we've reviewed on the show and at least one of us really love. So we're not necessarily looking for just the most critically acclaimed or the most lauded films of the year. We are focusing just on some movies that we've singled out to praise here, and we want to know which of these you have enjoyed the most. So the question is, what is your favorite movie of 2016 that we reviewed and at least one of us loved? Josh, the options are,
going way back to the start of the year for some of these, Everybody Wants Some from Richard Linklater is your first option. Green Room, that's from Jeremy Saulnier. Also, Hail Caesar, I think this was February. At the midpoint of the year, this was my number one. Mm. So we'll see where that lands. I've got to not only watch about 45 movies yet, I want to watch that again.
See, you rewatch
just
things.
Just to know.
I almost never get to fit in, or I never force myself to fit in rewatching something because there's too much I want to see. The Tree of Life was one exception where I knew I had to watch that again.
It's usually the ones that are vying for number one, and Hail Caesar is still in the race.
Mix, huh?
Yep. The Lobster, another one that's in that race from Yorgos Lanthimos. Moonlight, here's a recent film, Barry Jenkins' indie standout. Sing Street, which is from John Carney and was your number one at the midway point. We'll see if that holds up. This one I'm really hoping still cracks.
You better believe it.
Your top 10.
I'm going to do it just to spite you.
Sully from Clint Eastwood.
I can't believe the grin on your face. Wait, as you are mocking my pick?
Sorry, I fell asleep.
You're just mocking just Tom Hanks?
The movie. Man.
He's my number one actor of the year now just for that.
One more option for everyone. The Witch from Robert Eggers, the breakout horror film.
So having some fun here, but Sing Street and Sully, both very much in contention for my top 10. Hail Caesar and The Lobster, I was with you. Big fan of those films, but not as big of a fan really right now on the outside looking in.
I think you need to revisit both.
It's not going to happen.
I've already watched The Lobster a second time.
No kidding?
Yeah.
Wow. You're amazing. Back in July, four of these films were options in our best of the year so far poll. Everybody wants some. Hail Caesar, The Lobster, and The Witch. We did post this poll a few days early here in anticipation of the release of this episode. And so far, the results indicate, Josh, that the winner of that earlier poll still might be the one to beat here. That's all we're going to say. We're not going to try to otherwise sway you, but it's already shifting a little bit. And my guy, John Carney, is getting some, he's getting some love. There's a push there for Sing Street. We hope that you will share your vote now at filmspotting.net. If you leave a comment, and we hope you do, please let us know where you're listening from.
Is the haze working for you?
Not rubbing it, but we're getting pieces of stuff that don't have haze.
Was it an easy delivery, that one?
Yes, it's very easy.
Just a little bit of housekeeping here as we hear a scene from the trailer for Kirsten Johnson's Camera Person. She is a longtime documentary cinematographer. I was highly anticipating this movie. It was my number one most anticipated fall movie. And as a cinematographer, she pieced together for this film outtakes from her 25-year career to craft what she refers to in some opening texts as her memoir. And during our Golden Brick preview special, before Thanksgiving, Josh, we suggested that this film, along with the new Iranian film, Under the Shadow, recommended by Film Spotting listeners, could both be in Golden Brick contention, in contention for our favorite overlooked, underseen, non-mainstream movie of the year. And as we sit here now, having both seen Camera Person and Under the Shadow, are you going to check the box for them to be on the shortlist?
Yeah, I'll check the box for both of them, and I will lobby very hard for Camera Person. And this is one I almost avoided because it was just too Adam. It just sounded like, you know, documentary,
yeah,
first person,
how meta
personal,
do you get?
About movie making.
Right.
You know, who needs it? Let them have it. But wow.
Finally.
This thing was emotionally moving in ways I didn't expect. It functions in a lot of ways as an abstract film, which I think I'm maybe more interested in terms of the documentary form than the more standard first-person documentaries that I expected this to be.
Mm-hmm.
All of these images and scenes do start to come together in ways that are revelatory. Sometimes this is just aesthetically in that certain images are repeated and found throughout all these different locations across the globe. But really thematically, and we won't get into it now, and it's probably something viewers should discover on their own and make their own connections, because it's also a film I feel like 30 people could watch and you'd get, you know, 20 different ideas of what rises to the top from something like this. So Camera Person, I would very much want to see as a Golden Brick nominee.
Yeah, it is a film I'm a big fan of as well. And I didn't start out that way, which isn't to say I wasn't on board with it, but I did make the mistake, as you know I do, Josh, from time to time. I started this movie, well, most of the time, I started this movie really late at night, and I got about 40 minutes into it. And through those first 40 minutes, I wasn't really seeing the connective tissue. I still responded to the way she provided what I see as a little bit of humor, where she was setting up for the audience who she is as a cinematographer behind the camera by letting her presence be known in really funny, kind of clever ways. So as we lead into the opening credits, we get a scene where it's just a long shot of a horizon, of a landscape scene. And then it's been a while now, but I think she sneezes or something behind the camera. She does something to
shakes a little.
Yeah, and it shakes a little bit and it draws attention to her there. And as the movie goes on, not only do we see insights into her own personal life, but then we finally do get a moment where she is even revealed on camera. It's turned back on her. So it goes from that little sneeze to then later that full reveal. But as you get deeper and deeper into this film, you're right. You start to really see the connective tissue. And it's not just thematically, but it's also based on the fact that she goes back and does start to revisit some of the films and the scenes that we've seen earlier. And it is very striking. It is very moving at times. And I'm with you. I don't want to get into it too much here because it may come up in more detail here as we get into some later episodes this year. But I think it raises some provocative questions about the gaze of the documentarian filmmaker and the function of the documentarian Absolutely. Filmmaker without being an overly simple meta exercise at all. It isn't navel gazing here in any way. It really is opened up to the whole world, and it's about how anybody deals with terrible circumstances, I think, when you're actually in them as the person living through it, or you're the person capturing it, and how you look at it and how you then process it, I think is one of the fascinating questions that comes up in this film. So I'm with you completely on camera person. And really there's a little bit of tie-in with that theme, what I'm talking about in terms of certainly living through horror in Under the Shadow. As we said, an Iranian film that is about a mother who has a young daughter. What would you say? She's 6 or 7?
Yeah, that sounds right. Maybe 8, yeah.
Yeah, and she has a husband as well, but he goes off to fight in the war. It's set back in the 80s during the Iran-Iraq conflict. She's left at home with the daughter, and what we learn early in the film is that she was someone who got caught up in the Iranian revolution, the cultural revolution there, and now is kind of paying the price for it. As things have settled down, she wants to go back to med school and finish her studies, and she's simply not going to get that opportunity. So a movie about motherhood and about forging your own identity in a place that seems to want to prevent you from having any real kind of individual identity, I found it to be really pretty effective.
Yeah, it is effective. I think as a horror film, it becomes effective later. This is a really slow boil in terms, and I like horror films that are that way, but even for those, this does take its time mm-hmm. bringing those elements in and purposefully, and I think that makes the impact even that much greater. Towards the end, the political implications are maybe it's, the extra card it has to play in terms of this mother horror subgenre, which I'm a huge fan of.
Yeah.
I really like the Jennifer Connelly picture, Dark Water.
I do too.
And the Conjuring.
Babadook.
And
yeah.
Yes, the Babadook was on my top 10.
I haven't really mentioned that. There is a supernatural element to this horror film.
When
a missile comes through their apartment complex and then everyone kind of starts seeing ghosts.
Yeah. Yeah. And well, at the beginning, it's the daughter who claims mm-hmm. she sees these figures. And so it works that way. I think I'd rank the Babadook higher just because it's a little bit more formally interesting, mm-hmm. Perhaps. But
Maybe.
Again, that political element
yeah.
where, this woman has to be literally covered in one case,
mm-hmm.
even if a malevolent spiritual force is chasing her.
Right.
just the movie very smartly weaves those two things together so that it's not forced at all.
Yeah, and like a lot of great horror films, and The Babadook's a good reference point here because when we talked about that movie, I know we talked about how that whole film is very much a metaphor, and it's hard to even say a metaphor because it's present in the script, but it's about dealing with grief and how mm-hmm. this grief that the mother is unable to actually deal with, how it manifests itself then in the horror that plays out in their home. In this film, you have a main character who I think what she is really dealing with is, for lack of a better term, her dishonesty. And I use that very loosely because I don't think she's a bad person. I don't think she's a bad mother. I think she is flawed in the way so many of us are flawed, especially when you are caught between really tough decisions. And she's someone who very clearly does love her daughter, but also, like so many of us, realizes that she wouldn't mind having her own place in the world, separate from simply being a mother. And that's all this society wants to allow her to be. So we understand that split and then the anger and frustration that follows that split. What I mean by dishonesty is there's just a sense that she's never quite able to reconcile those two sides, and she's constantly in a state of denial. And because she won't accept really who she is, she won't accept, even in that opening scene when she's talking to that headmaster or whatever of the school, she's talking about her political activity as if she's taking no ownership of it. She really didn't believe it. She just got swept up in it. Have pity on me. Let me back in the school. At no point does she own who she really is as a person. And again, I don't hold that against her. I think that's what makes her a really fascinating character. But then that dishonesty, if you will, is what seems to haunt her literally throughout this whole film.
Well, yeah, the psychological fear here, and the main character is played by Narges Rashidi, the psychological fear is that she's not two things, the mother that she's expected to be,
yes,
and the mother that she wants to be.
Right.
It's not that she,
yeah,
that she doesn't
totally
want to be a mother. It's that she doesn't want to follow this traditional role.
Yep.
And that becomes amplified by the circumstances with her husband leaving,
mm-hmm,
by the circumstances with her not being able to pursue her degree. And then it sort of explodes literally when these attacks come upon their building, and at the exact time it's exploding in her mind.
Mm-hmm.
And so it does work. And these are, I think I do appreciate these. They're mostly revolving around mothers, but really they're parental horror films in general when they are almost too honest.
Right.
In that you reach a breaking point as a parent. My favorite shot in The Babadook is the close-up of her exhausted on the bed.
I know.
And in the background, you see the kid come in asking for a meal or something. And the look on her face is like, that's horror.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
when you just can't rouse yourself to be that good parent.
No, I saw a lot of similarities to the mother here. I have felt every one of those,
yeah,
emotions, you,
yeah,
know, just in terms of that struggle of wanting to be a good parent and knowing what a good parent would do
should
in this situation,
doing,
but,
yeah,
not being able to hide your real feelings, the raw emotion of that moment. I do think that you said it's a slow burn. It really is. And I think very intense because of that. I think its weakness is in the end of the film as it starts to try to get more blatantly supernatural. I'm not one who pays much attention to effects, especially horror type effects, but I don't think they're particularly effective here. I think it tries to veer off into a realm that a more conventional horror film would, and it doesn't offer any of the joys that those movies would. Not
okay
for me.
Okay. I think I can see where you're going. I also, you know, watched this at home.
Yeah, me
and
too.
And so the picture wasn't as pristine as I had hoped. So maybe a little forgiving in some of those late movie effects.
Sure. Under the Shadow, you can see it now. It's on iTunes. I think iTunes is the only way to see the movie. There might be some other streaming platforms, but I know iTunes for sure. Camera Person, Josh, is one I'm not sure about. I don't know that that's one that is currently available to see. If we do have any more information about it, we'll link to it in our show notes at filmspotting.net.
So, Adam, sometimes we like to bring in guest experts for our top five list. That is the case for this week's look at the best teenage girl movies directed by women. Critic and movie writer Mariah E. Gates spent an entire year watching only movies that were written or directed by women. I'd say she's qualified. Stay with us.
Back to our usual format here, Josh, we do have some donations we want to mention, some listeners we want to thank. But first, we want to highlight our featured artist this week. We are playing selections from Mika Levy's score for director Pablo Larraín's Jackie. And it seemed only fitting as we're focusing on women with this week's episode, The Edge of 17, and the top five list coming up, that we would feature one of the more acclaimed scores of the year here from a female composer, and we certainly thought that Levy's score for 2014's Under the Skin was one of the best, if not the best, of that year.
I had Levy as one of my top five discoveries of 2014 for
that's right
score. So
yeah, there you go. And just earlier today, as we sat down to record, our friend Scott Tobias from The Next Picture Show tweeted, "Is there a more important score for a movie this year than Mika Levy's for Jackie? The mesmeric intimacy of that film owes so much to it." So again, we still need to see the film, but I love that not only Scott felt compelled to highlight the score, he also used the word mesmeric, which I'm going to confess, didn't know was a word.
Is that a word? That sounds
I would just write
and then hope was a word.
I'm going to say if Scott, I mean, he's a professional.
Yeah, that's true.
So well done, Scott Tobias. Some donors we want to thank this week. Steve in Wixom, Michigan. I'm going to go with Wixom. And Ryan in Portland, Oregon.
I always appreciate your devotion to engaging content and passionate discussion. Your hard work comes through on every episode. When it comes to contributing, I'm not a pay the dealer guy. I'm a let's move some cans guy.
Let's move some cans. Well done. A callback to the old days of film spotting. And this gives us a perfect chance to interject, as Ryan is from Portland. This note from longtime listener Paul Rippey in Portland, his Sam Van Halgren nickname, Conscientious Projector. Very well done. Sam, he wanted to know what the best way is to get together with other film spotting fans. Are there towns where strangers get together to watch marathon movies? In fact, there are. How do they get arranged? I've posted on Facebook, but not aggressively. No results so far. So when these questions do come up, I will always direct people back to the Film Spotting Forum. There is a local events and meetup page there. We have lots of listeners in Portland. I'm sure some of them want to get together and talk film. So I think, Paul, you need to definitely start a link there, or if not, I'll actually start it as we post this episode, and I'll put a link in our show notes at filmspotting.net. If you're not sure where the forum is, you can find it that way, and we'd love to hear about any listeners in Portland or elsewhere getting together. A new $5 a month donor is Joseph in London, and also Wesley, who is in Lake in the Hills, Illinois.
In addition to my donation, I wanted to say thank you for all that you do. Having a love for cinema and desire to work in film, your podcast is truly the best resource to stay up to date on current films and also celebrate the great films from our past. I'm so excited to see you at Chuba's on November 18th. That day is my birthday, and there is no other way I would like to spend it. Congrats on the big 600, and here's to many more insightful and entertaining episodes to come. So I think I may have talked to Wesley.
You did. Okay. I wrote back to Wesley. Yeah, obviously got Wesley's note here before that episode, and we taped it at Shuba's, and I wrote him back and said, so Wesley, did we ever connect? I met a few people afterwards. I don't remember you. He said he did get a chance to talk to you.
Yeah, we were too rudely talking over Matt, I think.
There you go. Ruining Film Spotting SVU. Well done. Finally, a new $10 a month donor, Scott in Chicago. Thank you to Scott, Wesley, Joseph, Ryan, and Steve, and to everyone else who is a regular contributor to the show. You really do keep us doing what we're doing. A no-cost way you can help the show, rate or review us on iTunes. It does seem to matter, gets us in front of more people. And we want to thank some listeners who posted quick reviews over the past few weeks, including Doug Life 0301, Woolly Socks 87, and KF Punk, who says, I've been listening since this podcast was Cinecast, and I'm always excited when a new episode drops.
I used to wear woolly socks in 1987. Just 87.
Just 87? Just that year?
I was done in 88.
Cold year.
What about, you forgot to mention asterisk, colon, parentheses, who
is
said—
Is that the name?
Yeah. Who said, I've discovered so many movies I would never have heard of otherwise. Keep up the great work. What, they don't get credit just because they don't use any letters?
No, it's an apostrophe and an asterisk and a smiley face.
I think this is one of the aliens from Arrival.
It might be.
You're getting this one review, and then later tonight you'll get a noir review. The movie I saw was The Edge of 17, which was written and directed by Kelly Freeman Craig. This was her first film as a director. I thought this was a great film. It was released wide. It's the final wide release film directed by a woman this year. So if it's in a theater near you, please, please put your money where your mouth is and go see this film, because if you want to see more films by women, specifically more films released by the studios, you have to go see the films that are being released.
Critic and writer Mariah E. Gates there from the aforementioned YouTube review of The Edge of 17. We mentioned it and very favorably reviewed that movie earlier here in the show. That sentiment about supporting women at the box office also later expressed in a series of tweets that got our attention. And Mariah joins us now. She does social media for TCM and hosts the Female Filmmaker Friday podcast. It's so great to have you on the show, Mariah.
Thanks for having me.
So I sometimes get credit for being involved in a lot of things at once and yet somehow managing to get most of them done. But your list of activities kind of makes my head spin a little bit. Social media for TCM and Filmstruck, the creator of Noirvember, A Year with Women, and the female filmmaker Friday podcast, as we mentioned. Let's just start with Noirvember. Where did that come from? And for those people listening who have no idea what we're talking about, what is it?
So Noirvember started when I was sort of underemployed and living in the back of my parents' house in 2010. And I was watching a lot of Turner Classic Movies and getting really into classic cinema. And I was like, oh man, I don't know anything about film noir. I've seen Sunset Boulevard and like The Maltese Falcon and I'm out. And so I decided there was a list. I think it was probably the IMDb like top 50 list. And I was like, I'm going to tackle this list and I'm going to watch them and I'm going to invite people to do it with me because why not? And nobody did it with me. I think my friend Kristen watched Odd Man Out with me and somebody else watched Laura with me and all the rest of the films I watched on my own. But I had so much fun doing it that I decided to do it again the next year. And that year, you know, I had the hashtag all worked out and I got a couple of people more to do it. And then as the years have gone by, it's really grown into this really big thing. Part of that has to do with I started working for like media companies and convinced them to use the hashtag. That really helps.
Yeah.
So like I worked for Warner Archive Collection for a while and I got to do some Warner Archive Instant live tweets with the hashtag. And for the last 2 years, I worked at Rotten Tomatoes. So I got to do a Rotten Tomatoes photo gallery that did really well. And now just like there's people that look forward to it every year. There's not just film noir people, like there's this Veronica Mars fan account that I love that every year does sort of like, do you like noir? Here's how Veronica Mars is a noir. Or do you like Veronica Mars? Here's some noir that you would also like. And so she sort of, I assume it's a woman, she combines both so that if you're a Veronica Mars fan, you'll start liking noir. And if you're a noir fan, you'll start liking Veronica Mars. And I just think that's amazing. Mm-hmm. She does it every year. I look forward to it. I don't even watch this show and I look forward to her tweets. So
yeah, that's fascinating. I do have to ask because I love noir, though I'm sure there are so many. I know for a fact there are so many I still need to see. What have been the revelations for you as you've watched these films, particularly this year?
Well, this year I finally decided to tackle Japanese noir because I had a friend who a few years ago watched a bunch and was like, you'd like these. And I was like, I'll get to it. I'll get to it. And then I never got to it. And then so many of them were on Filmstruck. I was like, this is the year. So like discovering Seijin Suzuki has been just insane. He's a crazy filmmaker. I've only seen three of his like 50 films and I need to see them all now. I also saw another one called I Am Waiting that was just the most heartbreaking thing I've ever seen. It was such a beautiful film. So really finally diving into Japanese noir has been really just rewarding this year.
I love the intentionality you bring to your own film education and projects like that. And I think you could say the same to Year with Women, which you did 2015. Is that correct? When you spent,
yeah,
that was a year just watching only films written and directed or written or directed by women. Is that right?
So it was mostly directed. The only time I brought in the written was for Noirvember because I didn't want to not do Noirvember.
Okay.
So every film I watched during Noirvember was either screenplay written by or the original source material written by a woman. And then everything else I watched last year, including rewatches, were films directed by women.
So I saw in an interview with Kerrang! Magazine, I think it was, that you were partly inspired for that project by exhaustion with what you called masculine thought that was dominating the movies you had been seeing up to that point. So I'm curious if after that year, is it at all possible to characterize what feminine thought might look like at the movies? I wonder if you maybe came away with any sort of grand unifying theory of feminine cinema after immersing yourself in that way.
So I've been asked this question a few times and I still haven't been able to figure out how to verbalize it, but I know that it's different because when I started watching more male-centric cinema again, I started feeling uncomfortable again.
Hmm.
So I don't know how to really say it. Although I did see someone early in the year do like a 2-week, they call it like a juice cleanse, where they did 2 weeks of nothing but films directed by women, and they tweeted at me and they were like, I don't have words, but I feel so different. And I'm like, yeah. And I wish I knew how to say it in words. Like, this is how it feels different, but I can't, it just feels different.
Well, and sometimes, you know, you don't want to be reductive about it either, because that can limit the wide scope of what female directed films can be as well. So maybe it's best not to put it in words at the end of the day.
Yeah. I think the main thing is that it's not as male gazey, for one thing. That's mm-hmm. something that is just, it's not there, that sort of objectification of women. Even the sly objectification of women where they don't mean to do it, but it's there mm-hmm. in a lot of male cinema, that most of that is gone. And then even if you have sort of a lesbian female gaze, it tends to be way less icky and way more sort of a loving, sort of lustful gaze, if that makes any sense. Because I don't want to say that only men like ogle women. I clearly am a woman who ogles women, but I appreciate it when it's done in a very sort of tasteful way that doesn't feel like it's objectification. It's just sort of in praise of women.
Appreciative instead, maybe.
Yeah.
We have that full list. It's posted over at MUBI, I believe, your A Year with Women list. So we'll definitely link to that in our show notes for listeners to catch up with. And that's probably a good transition into our topic this week as we reviewed The Edge of 17, inspired by your tweets and your favorable take on that film. I approached you about doing a top five topic that related to it, and you had another movie list pretty much all set to go of teenage girl movies directed by women. And I think this is very telling here. It is hard for me to admit this, but looking at your list, which is now at 85 movies, I counted all of 13 that I've seen. So clearly, there's a hole in my film education here, and I won't get into all of those 13 here, as some I think will come up as we kind of get through your list and share a few picks of our own. But we're really curious to hear the five movies you identified as your favorite teenage girl movies that are directed by women, and take it away. You're number five.
Number five. So I wanted to, of those 85 films, I think I've seen 75 or so of them, missing a handful. Mm-hmm. So because I added some films that were recommended and I still haven't gotten to. So when I was picking it, kind of getting it down to five, I was like, okay, I want this to be representative sort of the list. So I tried to pick sort of little of everything, but also films that I have returned to many times. So number five was a film that I did not see in theaters, but desperately wanted to, but I grew up in the middle of nowhere and we very rarely got films from other countries, and that included British films. So we did not get this film. I had to rent it from the rental store back when that still existed. And this is Gurinder Chadha's Bend It Like Beckham. It mm-hmm. came out, I think, post or like just before Keira Knightley became huge with Pirates, probably made it to America right after Pirates. It's such a fun movie. It's about two girls that love to play soccer. They just want to play soccer. They're getting grief for two different reasons. She's getting grief because she's a girl and her parents are like, why don't you play, you know, do girl things? And then the other one is Parminder Nagra, and she is of Indian descent. So she's getting grief because Indian girls don't play soccer. You know, mm-hmm. and they become friends.
Hi. That was brilliant. Do you play for any side?
Yeah, like you, Southall United sorry squad.
Play for Hounslow Harriers, girls' side. It's closed season at the moment, but we've got a summer tournament coming up. You should come along, have a trial.
A trial? Think I'm good enough?
Yeah. Watched you a couple of times, you've gotten really good. I don't know, it's up to our coach, but I know we could do with some new blood.
Let's play football.
Yeah.
I'm Jules.
Oh, yes.
Hi.
The sad thing about this story, like background story-wise, is that originally they were supposed to be lesbians. And then there's a joke about that sort of in the movie later on. But I guess the studio or the financial backers were like, okay, we're already pushing enough boundaries with like sporty girls. I don't think we can have lesbians.
Didn't want to get carried away.
Yeah, it was like too much. And which is a bummer, especially because the subtext is so clearly there that I think Gurinder Chadha was like, okay, well, you won't let me make it text, so I'm just going to have it there. And, you know, all the girls who want to see it are going to see it like that. So,
well, Bend It Like Beckham, I think is – my ratio is somewhat similar to Adam's, unfortunately, on your list and the number I've seen. And Bend It Like Beckham is one of those that I do still need to see.
It's one I haven't seen, but I did have another Gurinder Chadha film I wanted to mention a little bit of a cheat, though, because the main characters aren't all teen girls, but her 1993 movie, I think it might have been her first I'm looking as a writer. It was her first story that wasn't a short. So I'm just checking real quick here as a director. No, she'd okay. Yeah, it was her first feature as a director. Baji on the Beach is a really great film about a cross section of women. They're all British, but they're all Indian, and they all decide to try to get away from their problems for a weekend and get away to this beach resort. And they don't really get away from their problems, and they spend a lot of time together, but it's a group of all different ages of women, including a couple teen girls. And I just remember this movie very, very fondly from my film school days. So another Chadha film I wanted to mention. But Bennett, like Beckham, a great pick. What's your number four?
Number four was Pariah. So now we finally get lesbians, like actual lesbian teenage girls in this movie. I saw this one in theaters, and when it was over, my friend and I who saw it together, we were like so grateful that our parents were supportive of us as teenagers, because the parents in this film are just not like, and Bennett, like Beckham, they give them grief, but eventually they let them go and pursue their dreams of being soccer players. Right. In Pariah, the main character who is growing up in the Bronx, she's a lesbian. She's very butch. She does not want to dress in like pretty clothing. She wants to be who she is. Eventually like has to leave home. She just can't be with her parents anymore. They aren't supportive. They're not going to let her be who she is. It's really heartbreaking to watch, because you see her sort of grow into who she is as a teenager. And like most teenagers, you know, you're sort of discovering what it is that you like and how you want to present yourself. And you see her grow in finding the lesbian culture, but you also see her getting pushed, you know, further and further into the proverbial closet by her parents. And it's really heartbreaking to watch, and it's beautifully directed. It's written and directed by Dee Rees, who also did Bessie last year on HBO. It's her only, I think, feature film that's been in theaters since Bessie was a TV movie. It's kind of depressing. I want to see more movies from her.
Yeah, that's surprising, because I haven't seen Pariah either, but I remember it being a much talked about film at least, and you would hope it would have led to another project for her, feature project at least.
She, if you ever read the, I think it was last year, the New York Times did a profile of, I want to say 50 female directors all talking about their ups and downs. And her interview is one of the most heartbreaking, where you basically see like this film should have opened so many doors and it didn't.
Well, we're partly guilty on that one. Pariah also a regret for me, but we're going to get back onto more familiar ground, I think, here, Mariah, with your next three picks. What is your number three?
So number three is actually the film. Last year I did this poll where I had 500 people, both from casual film viewers all the way to people like Julie Dash. People, so the gamut from you know, like Tumblr users to Julie Dash gave me their list of their favorite most essential films directed by women. And this is the film that topped the list. It's a little controversial, but I completely agree, because I think it's an essential, that being Amy Heckerling's Clueless.
Hi, how old are you?
I'll be 16 in May.
My birthday is in April, and as someone older, can I please give you some advice? It is one thing to spark up a doobie and get laced at parties, but it is quite another to be fried all day.
Do you see the distinction?
Yeah. Pilotes generally hang on the grass scene all over there. Sometimes they come to class and say bonehead things, and we all laugh, of course, but no respectable girl actually dates them.
Mm-mm.
You don't want to start off on the wrong foot now, do you?
I've got an idea. Let's do a makeover.
No.
No.
Oh, come on, let us. Cher's main thrill in life is a makeover, okay? It gives her a sense of control in a world full of chaos.
Please.
Sure.
Why not? You guys, I've never had straight friends before.
I think it is such a brilliant adaptation of Austin. It's just, it's definitive of the 90s. Like, everything that I think about in the 90s is sort of in this film. It doesn't do that thing where it makes up fake language for the teenagers. Instead, it just sounds like the teenagers of its era. It sounds like she was hanging out in high school and going, wow, these are strange words, but I'm going to have my kids say it because this is what kids are saying. It has iconic characters all the way from Alicia Silverstone as the main character to Brittany Murphy.
Mm-hmm.
And then it gave us Paul Rudd Like, it's the beginning of Paul Rudd, who he looks exactly the same in this film. He does now. It's just such a great film.
Yeah. It gave me the term complaint rock to describe my favorite kind of music, apparently. So
I think we're both in agreement with you on this one. I actually, on episode 572, we did our list of top five comedies about the rich, and I had Clueless on that one. I actually also had Sofia Coppola's The Bling Ring, speaking of teenage girl movies directed by women. So, yeah, Clueless is fantastic.
You know, I'm sure many, many people much smarter than me have pointed this out, but in you mentioning Clueless being this definitive piece of cinema from the 90s, capturing the 90s, it of course makes me think that Heckerling did that as well with Fast Times at Ridgemont High, 81, 82, where it's just perfectly capturing the end of the 70s and the dawn of the 80s. And then she did it again in capturing the zeitgeist.
Spiritual
with Clueless.
Sequel, perhaps.
Yeah, maybe it is. Your number two.
Last year, I went to two different sold-out screenings. One was of Clueless, and it was on one of those rooftop screenings. Completely sold out. And then the other was Fast Times. It was like a flashback Thursday thing.
Yeah.
I was thinking, Clueless I thought was going to sell out. But when I went to the Fast Times one, I kind of came a little late because I was like, no one comes to these things. And I couldn't barely even get a seat. And it made me so happy.
Yeah. I would love to see Clueless with a crowd. I've only ever seen it on HBO. So.
Oh, it plays really well with a crowd. I've seen it a few times now in theaters, and it's like people just love it. And yeah. it you feel, you know how when you watch a movie and everyone is loving it and mm-hmm. the experience, you're all experiencing it together. That's how this movie feels. Seeing it on a rooftop, people were like shouting out their favorite lines.
Of course.
Yeah.
Dancing like Elton. And so we're going to get to decidedly less happy territory with your number two pick, right?
Yes. So this is a film that I saw when I was a teenager the first time. And sadly, I watched it not because I knew the director, but because supposedly Hayden Christensen was in it. And that's why I was trying to watch it. And he is. He's like blink or miss it kind of action with him. But it's Sofia Coppola's The Virgin Suicides. And I'm glad that I've rewatched it many times since then, because there's so much more than just Hayden Christensen in a car in this film. I actually think it is a sort of before and after moment for cinema. I think there are so many films, not just by women, but by men and women, that sort of riff on the aesthetic that she sets up in this film. And I think even just last year, I saw three different films about teenage girls that owed so much of their spirit and aesthetic to this film, that it's kind of wonderful to see a text being referenced by other filmmakers from such a strong viewpoint. I think Sofia has such a strong point of view, and like, she's a love it or hate it, you know, filmmaker, but she has such a strong point of view, and we're starting to see that influence on other filmmakers.
People saw their clairvoyance in the wiped out elms, the harsh sunlight, and the continuing decline of our auto industry. Even then, as teenagers, we tried to put the pieces together. We still can't. Now, whenever we run into each other at business lunches or cocktail parties, we find ourselves in the corner going over the evidence one more time. All to understand those five girls, who after all these years, we can't get out of our minds. Cecilia, the youngest, was 13. And Lux was 14. Bonnie was 15. Mary was 16. And Therese was 17.
So another crossover here with my list. I had Clueless at number three. At number five, I did have Virgin Suicides. I think Coppola, you know, right from the beginning of her career, was capturing young womanhood as something that was both tortured and charmed, is a quality that's not only in Virgin Suicides, but carried through so many of her films.
Yeah, I'd say tortured and charm also applies to a film that I considered for this list. I wonder if it would be eligible, but Marie Antoinette is another film that opens with a very young teenage Marie. And of course, then we see her get a little bit older throughout the rest of the film. But definitely one I thought about here, and any Coppola film for this list is a great choice. Your number one, Mariah.
Okay, so this one I have seen so many times. I even got to see it, I guess it was also last year. Yeah, with Andrea Arnold in person. which made it even better because then she got to illuminate all these questions that I had, like, why is it shot? Why does she shoot in that, you know, cramped ratio?
Mm-hmm.
And her answer was because her films are about these people, and she feels like that's when you have it as that square ratio, you are following that person's point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, this makes so much sense now. Oh my
right.
God. What I love about it is I'm a really big fan of those like 1960s angry young man films.
Yep.
And this, you could plop this film in that like kitchen sink drama 60s and it would fit perfectly, except that it's now the housing projects in the aughts, but it's basically the same angst, the same sort of circle of poverty, the same everything. And then you have this girl who's like, she's found this one thing that makes her happy and this one thing that will maybe give her a future. But like, you're also like, this girl thinks that hip hop dancing is the only thing that she has. It's kind of sad, but she's good at it. So you're hoping maybe she'll find some way to be able to use it. And kind of like the first two films, she's also sort of ill at ease with her family. But what I like about the ending of the film is that even though she knows she has to leave them and she knows she has to try to find a future elsewhere, she still loves them. And that love is still there. And the love with her mother, who knows she's not done a good job, but it's still her daughter. And so it's that moment where they're all dancing and just sort of being as best they can a family. Mm-hmm. is a beautiful moment. And I think this is the themes that are show up in Fish Tank, show up in most of Andrea Arnold's work, especially her shorts. If you've watched her shorts, I think she's just really interested in ordinary people trying to do the best they can.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a film I appreciate quite a bit as well. When we reviewed it on the show, it's so funny that you bring up the Angry Young Men movies because we had just completed a marathon of those films on the show. Six or seven of those movies we watched and discussed, movies that we'd never seen before. And then I saw Fish Tank a short time after that marathon concluded. And it was so refreshing to see something similar in terms of capturing that kitchen sink sort of neo-realist aesthetic, but doing it completely from the female point of view. And that film really is all about her point of view. Everything we see is either that character or what she's looking at. And certainly that aspect ratio, as you mentioned, it just helps add to that kind of confined nature of her existence, which she really does have living kind of in this housing project, essentially. So it's a great film with, of course, a great performance by Michael Fassbender in that one.
So, and
and there's a really wonderful female gaze in this film where she's just like Fassbender. I can't ever unthink the scene where he's completely shirtless and like stretching and his back is just like perfectly arched and she's staring at him and you can see her staring at him and you're just like, I would be doing this. I would be staring at him too.
Mm-hmm.
You're up late.
Been busy.
You're my friend now.
What?
Seemed a bit funny with me the last few days.
You've been funny with me.
Have I? Maybe.
When I rewatched Fish Tank, when I saw it in theaters, there's a moment where the main character says as if, the same way that Cher does in Clueless. So you know that this character has seen Clueless.
Uh-huh.
And is quoting it to be sassy.
Right, which is great because those two worlds couldn't be more antithetical. So that's
exactly.
So perfect. Yeah.
So Mariah, I have to ask because I just watched American Honey because I wanted to be sure to catch that in general this year. I was looking forward to it. Big fan of Wuthering Heights, especially of Arnold's. And I thought it might pertain to these lists. And I have to say something was missing for me from it. And again, just saw it, so I'm still processing it, but maybe you can fill in, if you're a fan of it, what was missing or
you were wrong about?
Or yeah, just tell me what I was missing. That is, if you've been able to see it yet.
Yeah, I saw it and I really, really loved it. When it ended, I didn't realize it was ending. And
yeah.
I was like, oh, come back, movie. I want to still be in this movie. Where'd you go? Come back. Like it was one of those moments where I was just like, can I get another ticket and go right back in? That's sort of how I felt.
And that's saying something at a film that's nearly 3 hours, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I never even realized that 3 hours had gone by. I think part of why it really worked for me is I grew up in a really, really small town that was really, for the most part, economically challenged. And this, it felt true to the kind of people that grow up in that town and how they end up as teenagers and how they end up sort of drifting. And I don't know, I just felt like it really, really captured the circle of poverty that she also captured in Fish Tank. But instead of in London, she transports that to the America, like rural poverty and how, and sort of rural and urban poverty, but mostly rural poverty, and how there is a certain group of young people in America that ends up, they don't have, especially in the recession, they don't have the jobs, they don't have skills, they get sucked into this scam. I actually once had a magazine crew come up to me when I was in college and I was like, what is happening? So I found that really fascinating. And the sort of the allure, the American allure of the road is just ingrained in Americans. So having this culture of just drifting from place to place really, I don't know, just really captured something that I felt was true.
So I'll say, you know, the thread that I did grab onto is what you talked about there at the start. I think the strongest portion is towards the end when this magazine crew ends up in a more economically depressed town. Usually they've been going after, you know, the more well-to-do folks, but here yeah. they're trying to sell these magazines, and it's sort of a cycle where she ends up back in a home, which is one that she had escaped from. And so I think the movie is starting to hit on something there that could have really worked more for me, maybe if I'd seen it as more of a through line, but yeah. certainly one that's been divisive this year. So glad to get your take.
Josh, we've heard a couple of your picks that would populate your top five list. Any others you want to throw out?
Yeah. So Virgin Suicides, I mentioned at number five. I've got a pair here at number four, which it's a cheat in two ways. It's a pair, Sweetie and Holy Smoke. Those are two early Jane Campion films, and they both feature women, I think, in their 20s about. But they're dealing with parents and family and establishing their own identities. So they're very much still coming of age stories, which is why I threw them on this list. Number three was Clueless. Number two is An Education. This is Carey Mulligan as a teen in 1960s suburban London who's being wooed by an older man. And I think what makes this cliched storyline work is this goes back to the gaze element we've been talking about. This is told completely from the woman's perspective, and the director is Lone Scherfig there. Mm-hmm. My number one, this is embarrassing. I had my list pretty much done today, put something out on Twitter about that this is what we're recording tonight, and I had Daniel Bindus, he's at 86 Mookie, say, surely you have Winter's Bone on your list. Had completely forgotten about it.
Yeah,
and
too.
I don't know how. It was my favorite movie of that year, directed by Deborah Granick, and this is Jennifer Lawrence's breakout role as a 17-year-old girl negotiating this perilous existence in backwoods Missouri. I always think of the line that one of her male neighbors delivers as she's searching for her missing father, "Ain't you got no men can do this." Hmm. And that just kind of reverberates through that film and through, you know, a lot of the movies we're talking about on these lists.
Yeah, wow, that's a great pick, and one I had completely spaced on as well. Just a couple other titles that haven't come up yet that I'll throw out. Fat Girl, the Catherine Bayard film, is my number five. The Edge of 17, which we've talked a lot about, I have at number four. I love Casey Lemon's Eve's Bayou. That's my number three. Marielle Heller's The Diary of a Teenage Girl from last year. And my number one is Hecker Lane's Fast Times at Ridgemont High. But going back to Eve's Bayou, Casey Lemon's is a filmmaker you've had on your podcast, right, Mariah?
We did a podcast
about her.
Angelica Jade Bastian came on and talked with me about her. She's a filmmaker that is so like her, another one whose point of view is so succinct and so different from other voices. And each one of her films has that point of view, but is about a different topic. And I just think she's brilliant. And I want like all of her movies. And she's someone who makes like a movie once every, you know, 7 years. And mm-hmm. I'm like, please someone give her money to make more films because I know she's always writing.
Yeah. Yeah. Angelica Bastian, a Film Spotting co-host this year, and Casey Lemons, an early Film Spotting interview. She came on to talk about Talk to Me. So that episode is in our show archives. But what about any other honorable mentions, movies that you haven't had a chance to throw out the titles of yet, Mariah?
Well, I was thinking when I was talking about Sofia Coppola's influence, the films that I saw last year that I felt really owed a lot to Virgin Suicides were I Believe in Unicorns, which is Leah Meyerhoff, Summer of Sangel, which is, I always say her name wrong, Adelante Caveate. It's like, I think it's Lithuanian. I saw that in theaters twice. I loved it so much. And obviously Mustang by Denise Gamzi Erdoven. All three of those films, I saw them last year, all three of them are similar in that they're like angsty coming-of-age teenage girl movies, but they're all very different. But they all have an aesthetic that you can see the aesthetic influence from Virgin Suicides throughout all three of these films. They're so like, they have that sort of gauze almost feel to them. If you know what I, mm-hmm. what I'm getting
yeah,
at with the gauze.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. And they're just, they're flowery in the way they look, but they're heavy, soulful, beautiful films that aren't just like, they take that flowery sort of dainty, you know, ballet kind of feel on the outside, but on the inside, they're telling these really deep, beautiful, soulful stories, but still have that sort of fairy like gauze on the outside. Mm-hmm. But because they understand that you can, these filmmakers understand that you can be sort of light and beautiful and quote unquote feminine from an aesthetic point of view and still be serious about your subject and still have a serious discussion about girlhood. I think that's something that takes a woman who's gone through teendom to really do. Another one was Breathe, Melina Laurent's Breathe. That one, like, is so beautiful to watch, but, and not even with just the ending that's crazy, but like the whole film is beautiful to watch, but also like is so true to the emotions of like having a best friend as a girl that when it was over, I was like, I am so glad I'm not 16 again. I hope I never have a daughter. I don't want her to go through that. Like, horrible. It was great. Like, it was one of those ones where it was like, this is horrible. I can't believe I'm watching this. Wow, I'm glad someone finally put this on film. It was amazing.
Yeah. Well, lots of great stuff to catch up with if you haven't already. And we will link to all the movie lists that we've mentioned here on the show in our show notes at filmspotting.net. We will also link to all of Mariah's various endeavors if you are curious to seek those out. This was a lot of fun, Mariah. Thanks so much for making the time and sharing your insights. Anything else that you want to plug?
No, just, you know, watch films by women, like both in theaters and at home. It'll really expand your worldview, I think.
Absolutely. Thank
and
you.
People should keep up with you on Twitter too, Mariah, to keep track of all the things you're doing. That's Old Films Flickr is your handle there. So thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
A lot of titles there we covered and even more on Mariah's movie list. If you have some you want to add in terms of teenage girl movies directed by women, please send those to feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also share them at our Facebook page. And we are also on Twitter. Adam's at FilmSpotting. I'm at Larson on Film. If you go over to FilmSpotting.net, you'll find 11 years of reviews, interviews, and top fives. Those are in the show archives. And while you're there, vote in the current FilmSpotting poll. We're asking of the movies we loved this year, what's your favorite? Also, if you haven't already, please check out the FilmSpotting family of podcasts. That's The Next Picture Show and FilmSpotting SVU. Both of those can be found in iTunes or through your favorite podcast app.
Out wide this weekend, a new horror film, Incarnate, and in limited release, The Eyes of My Mother, a indie horror debut feature flagged as a potential Golden Brit candidate back in January when it played at Sundance. David Ehrlich said, like someone fell asleep towards the end of Texas Chainsaw Massacre and then had his horrifically beautiful monochrome nightmare. What a thing to watch. Yet another movie we have to add to that ever-growing priority list.
I guess so.
Jackie is also out from Chile's Pablo Larraín, the director of No. Natalie Portman stars as Jackie Kennedy in the immediate aftermath of JFK's assassination. Next week on the show, our plan right now, Michael Phillips will be back. We will also have a special guest, Desiree Garcia, who is the Associate Professor of Film and Media Studies at Arizona State University. She's also a musicals expert. She's written a book on musicals. And what about this? Guy and Madeline on a Park Bench, Damien Chazelle's debut film. She's Madeline in that film.
So you can see where we're going with this.
Yes, yeah, maybe.
Main
eminently
review?
Qualified to come on and talk La La Land.
Can't wait for
yeah,
La La Land.
And to talk musicals. So we still, of course, have to get a chance to see La La Land
yeah,
in anticipation of the show.
Yeah, this is all dependent upon that.
We may be going with Manchester by the Sea. No musical numbers in that film. If you have a favorite musical number, you can be part of the show. Leave us a voicemail, and we may use it on the episode 312-264-0744. You can find that number under the About Us tab at filmspotting.net. You also have to sing whatever song is providing the music for your favorite dance number.
No, you don't really.
Or hum the tune.
We'd prefer that. Not required.
No.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths and the listeners of the Film Spotting Advisory Board. And special thanks to everyone at WBEZ Chicago. More information is available at WBEZ.org. If you like what you heard, give us a rating or a review on iTunes. That does help us reach new listeners. Our music this week comes from Mika Levy. It's the score to Jackie. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
So you've already proven you're smarter than me. You picked up on the arrival reveal about 3/4 of the way through, maybe?
Yeah, or
basically before the end credits.
I did beat you there, which isn't to say that I perfectly tapped into everything that I think the movie, now in retrospect, was trying to do. So, yeah, I'm not sure exactly where you want to start. I can definitely lay out for you what I think is happening in the film and what's been corroborated by a couple things I've read. And I can tell you what I also didn't latch on to at all when I saw it.
Okay.
And I'm still trying to make sense of.
Well, let me ask you a question. So, basically, this is spoiler talk. Alert, alert.
Yes.
It is revealed that what we presumably thought were flashbacks involving this daughter she has who gets sick and we see dies, and that's very early on in the film.
Mm-hmm.
Those are flash forwards.
Yes.
They're visions of what will happen to her in the future.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So we're in agreement on that. My question is she aware – when does she experience those, or are we only experiencing those?
Okay. I think I have an answer.
Okay.
I think, because I've thought about this a lot, and now I really want to rewatch the whole film.
Yeah, so do
with
I.
With the knowledge. I think anybody would.
And let me preface this. Like, my not getting it,
yeah.
I'm putting on myself, not on the film. Like, this isn't a criticism
for me.
Yeah.
Yeah, so. I do think the way I was going to put it is, because I'm not here to make you or anyone else or me be put on the defensive, which is easy to have happen when you talk about what you got and didn't get.
Right.
I do think the movie, especially in retrospect, where you've had time to really ponder it, is deceptively simple. Like, I don't think it's nearly the mind bender that Enemy is or most David Lynch films are. Like, it's there's just many films that are way more complex than this film is.
It is trying to function. Enemy is not as clear in terms of what it's about,
right?
But it functions similarly. So Villeneuve clearly likes this sort of structure.
I think he does. Yes,
yeah.
Definitely. The nonlinear thing is very important to him.
But anyways, I distract you. Go back to the question of when she's experiencing.
Here's what I think happens.
Okay.
I think that it works on the one level of just being purely about the audience for the first half of the film or so, because the only flashbacks that occur are at the beginning of the film. Again, this is what I want to verify, but hear me out.
Flash forwards, you mean?
Though. Well, yes, but
okay,
we perceive them as flashbacks.
Got it.
Because two things. One, we come from a culture that perceives time and we take in events linearly in sequence. And we are used to things moving from left to right.
Yep.
And we see these things that through the course of movie history have been presented as flashbacks. So we immediately believe that these are flashbacks.
We've been trained.
At some point in the movie, she starts to have visions again that are in sync with those, what we perceive as flashbacks earlier in the film.
Mm-hmm.
Things that seem to be from the past about her daughter dying. But they don't start until she is some way into the learning process of the language that she has been interfacing with the aliens on. So they start up at some point. So at that point, she is. We don't know how she's perceiving because she doesn't tell us. We simply see her having these moments where she seems to be very flustered by a vision or something or a memory. We don't know, obviously, at that time. We know later that they're not. Well, they are memories, actually, because that's the whole point of the film, is that the past, present, and the future are all actually intertwined as one time.
If your mind's working this way.
If your mind's working the same way as the aliens. So it doesn't start until she's learned the language.
So her experience of learning the language is what gives her the ability to do this, rewires her.
Okay. And that's the thing that I felt like an idiot that I didn't totally catch up on. And I think this goes back to being wired a certain way as a moviegoer, where because I so strongly was convinced that those were flashbacks, not because Villeneuve necessarily really paints them that way, just because it's easy for us to fall into that default mode mm-hmm. and think that that's what they are. We perceive them to be that. And so when she's having these visions or whatever they are, I wasn't tapping into the fact, even though Jeremy Renner's character literally says it. He says at one point, oh, I've been reading about this theory where if you start to learn a new language, it can kind of rewire your brain. I mean, they spell it out for you at that point. But I was so convinced that what was really going on was somehow Amy Adams was imbued with some kind of gift because she had gone through this tremendous suffering mm-hmm. and maybe just because of her heightened intellect and her interfacing with the aliens, something was happening in her where she was imbued with a gift that was being drawn out of her by the process with the aliens. And this isn't something anybody else could have ever picked up on. It's just something she's experiencing. I think what we come to learn by the end of the film is when we see in these now flash forwards that she writes a book about this language, the notion is actually that anybody, in theory, could learn this language, and that, in fact, the aliens are trying to give a gift to humanity.
No, they say that.
They say that. They're giving a gift to humanity of everybody, in a way, should be rewired to view time as one thing. Now, my question for you, the thing that really the movie has me thinking about, and I think in a good way, is how is that a gift? Beyond the fact that the movie lays it out as a gift the aliens are giving us because they say it's a gift. And you could argue that there's a certain element of a gift, of a good thing in a person having the perspective that even though the thing I'm about to embark on, I know is going to ultimately bring me tremendous pain and misery, I can recognize that it's worth the journey. And there are going to be so many other happy moments that I wouldn't have otherwise. It's worth it to go through the suffering to have the happiness. You could say that's a gift. But at the same time, other than potentially saving humanity, I think that's what's going on here too. I think the implication is that they say at one point that the humans help them in like 3,000 years.
Right.
And the
That's
only way the
motivation.
Humans, yeah, the only way the yeah. humans, beyond them being able to speak their language, the only way that they'll be able to be helped is if the humans are still around.
Right.
And they're only going to still be around if they all work together and if they save the planet in some way or another. And you're given that perspective if, for example, if you were someone who is, let's say, a climate change denier, and all of a sudden your brain is rewired to start to perceive the future,
right.
you might come to have a completely different take on the future of your planet and you would change your ways. So, but all that said, Josh, my question is that really just for you, would you want to be in Amy Adams' shoes where you now live your every day where the past, the present, and the future all feel like one thing to
you?
Yeah,
and you know that all the pain that you're going to receive. No, of course not. I mean, I think there's a very practical reason, plot reason, why it's portrayed as a gift, and that's that she can then prevent the world war that's about to happen. You know,
right.
So that's the
reason.
But
they want everybody to have the gift. The aliens seem to want everyone to have
the gift. Well, that ties into them
gift.
Saying so that they can, you know,
be
humanity
later.
Can help later.
And that's why she writes the book.
Right. To your question, though, I think why people are responding to this emotionally, and this is not an emotional response I had at all, so this is another way I feel left out of this film, is because I appreciate it overall and, you know, like so many things about it, but did not have this overwhelming emotional response people are having. I think it's because they clued into this earlier, started to think more about the possibility of this ability before I did, and then start to see parallels with, well, this is how we live anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't know the details, but it makes stark for us that no matter what is ahead, it's not all roses and sunshine.
And we don't have a choice.
And we don't have a choice either. So all we're spared really are the details.
Yes.
And so there's something very universally comforting is maybe not the word, but consoling in that this is the human experience.
Yes. I agree with
that. And so in that way, I can really see how this is resonating for people. I also very much have sensed a divide just in the timing of seeing this. On the show, we reviewed it. Michael and I had seen it Monday night
before the
election Tuesday.
Right.
And obviously had no lens of the results to view this through. And the vast majority of the responses I've seen, I don't know if you read it this way, but have been perfectly through that lens.
I think it's undeniable.
Here's a movie of world unity.
Yeah.
And you know, it feels so good right now.
It would have fit perfectly with our top five movies that console and restore hope. And I wanted to see Arrival before that list just because, based on little nuggets I was picking up on, I thought, well, this might be a contender.
And that's a really fascinating question, too. I don't think it makes it a better movie or a worse movie, but it certainly has given Arrival more esteem than if it had come out, say, in June. So, how do you weigh something like that?
The day
the Earth Stood Still is the same message. It's the same exact message, right? And an excellent sci-fi film, perhaps a superior one. If that had come out 2 days before something like this current election, you know, it would be seen through that lens too.
It's heightened, but the message of Arrival ultimately is also universal and timeless, unfortunately, about the human condition and about our inability to do those things, to work together.
You can't hold it against the film.
No, I don't think you can.
Kind of fascinating.
I think actually that does heighten the experience, and I think that's a good thing. Now, I do want to say this because we shared an experience in that, and I was talking to Sam about this, and I hope he doesn't mind me sharing this, but he told me he had seen it, and while he said it wasn't the emotional experience at all that the movie Interstellar was, kind of similar movies, you know.
Yeah,
very much so. I can see the connection there. And I'm with him on that. We had a similar love for that film and a strong emotional reaction to it. He said it wasn't the same, but Arrival made him tear up a couple times. So I sat through the whole film and I was provoked intellectually.
Yeah.
But I was so provoked intellectually that I never did tap into the emotion of it. And this is a movie about a mom watching her daughter die of cancer. Like, that's a huge part of the film.
Don't
and,
you usually...
and I'm very susceptible to that kind of film.
Okay, or do you recoil? Because
for me, it can go either way,
where it's like, oh, you're going to use this? You better make it work.
Well, that's a good point, because I will admit that as we got into it, I started thinking about Gravity, and I started thinking about all the movies that are driven by, sci-fi or otherwise, that are driven by a dead kid.
Yeah.
And yes, sometimes, yes, I'm susceptible to it because I think it's done right a lot of times, but you're right. Sometimes it feels really manipulative. And I think I was standing back. Now then the twist here, the reveal, I think justifies it.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And but, Adam's performance, the way that she makes it, you know, she mines truths out of cliches.
Agreed. But even when at the end of the film, I had put it all together and I recognize what she was sacrificing, and we can say it's the human condition and what choice does she have, but she actually does have a choice to make. She could choose not to go through all that future suffering. I mean, that's very clear. Like the moment where this is the closest I got to an emotional reaction, but I'm just saying it didn't hit me. To put in perspective, and it's very hard to describe to someone what an emotional reaction feels like, but I got a little choked up, if you will, two different points in Moana. I got choked up at two different points within the same 2-minute span in The Edge of 17 at the end of that film. Just little moments, gestures where moments are revealed for the characters, where they have a reversal. They were profoundly moving. There's a lot of profound things going on in Arrival, but the closest one for me is when she says to him, "I forgot how good it felt to be touched by you." She says that to him when she hugs him. Now, she's hugging him when the whole alien thing has ended, right? Mm-hmm. And we think that that's the end of the story, but it's really the beginning of the story.
Right.
They then get married and have a child and do these things. So that moment where she's now experienced life having lost him as a husband and about to gain him as a husband.
That
moment where she says, "I forgot how good it felt to be touched," like that could have been really emotional, but I didn't feel it in the moment. I thought about it afterwards and felt, "Oh, that's kind of profound and deep."
I think
it didn't hit me.
It was probably the same because I was more intellectually processing what that meant than feeling it.
Yeah, I was. I'm intrigued by people like Sam and others who say, "No, it really got him." But then again, I definitely don't mind a movie that has me still thinking about it days afterward and wanting to talk about it here like this. Like, I think that's great. So yeah, Arrival. There you go. Spoiler talk. Film Spotting is listener supported. Join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com and get access to ad-free episodes, monthly bonus shows, our weekly newsletter, and for the first time, all in one place, the entire Film Spotting archive going back to 2005. That's at filmspottingfamily.com.